welcome to Chem 12A. Morning section, I've already seen you, of course. Afternoon section, if you slipped in just a tiny bit late, I will be doing roll call in the lab, and I'll handle any of the registration questions that you have there. To anticipate some of the questions, though, hopefully you've already gotten my email, those of you officially enrolled in the class, or those of you officially on the wait list. I will be trying to add students all through these first couple of weeks. So even if you don't happen to get in today, up through Friday of next week, I will be trying to add students in. If you're on the wait list, you're perfectly welcome to keep on trying each day, coming to lecture. There is also a third section of OChem that is operating on Tuesday, Thursday, and Fridays. I've already gotten a couple of requests for trying to switch sections. In fact, I have a student here from Section 3 who is desperately trying to get into either of the other sections, correct? Is there anybody from Section 2 that already knows the schedule for Section 3 and would like to swap? Not yet, so we'll work on them. And if anybody wants to swap between sections 1 or 2, don't tell me now. Go look at the schedule. If you think it might work, let me know, just so I can try to accommodate as many people as I can into the course. As far as the syllabus, section 1 we covered it this morning. Section 2 will be extensively going over the syllabus in lab, so addressing scheduling, what's going to go on the course, how many exams, grades, things like that. We will discuss later. But because OChem is such a heavy topic, so much information, I wanted to go ahead and start a normal lecture today. So hopefully everybody got the notes to go ahead and bring their lab or their lecture notes. I almost said lab notes. Again, I'm going to recommend that you not use your lab books to take your notes in, just because I will be collecting those at some point, and they tend to get more frequently lost. Now, again, for Section 2, I will be doing registration in the green sheet later, but are there any general questions aside from that that any of you wanted to ask before we go ahead and begin? Then, if you could go ahead and hit the lights for me, please. What is organic chemistry? Typical question the textbook starts out with. A lot of OChem instructors start with it. I thought, okay, I'll start with it as well, just so we have an idea of what it is that we're going to be covering these three quarters of OChem. Anybody have an idea, an answer? Yes, sir. Study of carbon, essentially. Organic chemistry at one point was classified as the chemistry of things that were made by living objects. However, in the 1800s, it was discovered that we could synthesize our own cells those very same compounds. And so the definition grew to incorporate nearly anything that is carbon-containing. So this is going to be the chemistry of carbon, which, since we are carbon-based, that's partly why we're so concerned about it. For organic chemistry, there's going to be several layers of topics that we're going to study. The first part of the quarter, if you've looked at either the old version of the syllabus that was posted, or I did post a draft version of this quarter syllabus, so if you haven't seen it yet, it's got the full topic list. You'll see that we're going to cover a lot of the topics that we had in the Chem 1 sequence. So in fact, much to everybody's joy, I'm sure, we're going to go back and do a little itty-bitty baby version of quantum, because the only way we can truly get at the structure of organic molecules is if we have at least a working understanding of what an orbital is, what an energy level is. We have to know, how does bonding work? The distinction between the sigma and the pi bond, for example, makes a huge structural difference in the way that organic molecules tick. Once we spend some time studying first a little bit of about atomic theory and then molecular theory, we're going to then cover some of the big topics of Chem 1B, kinetics, thermodynamics, and equilibrium, because we have to be able to predict, is it likely that a reaction is going to happen? Is it going to release or require energy? Even if it releases energy, that doesn't mean the reaction may occur quickly. And so that's why we need to know something about kinetics. Or, as many organic reactions are reversible reactions, that's why we need to know something about equilibrium. As we cover those topics, it's not going to be the same type of presentation we did have in Chem 1, because you've already passed Chem 1. So I'm going to be using some organic examples to reteach these topics to the level that we do need just for this course. We will then start branching out, and even along the way, we'll start getting more into areas that you hadn't studied back in Chem 1A. So you might have learned, for example, about stereoisomers, but we're going to learn a lot more about stereoisomers and other forms of isomers, molecules that are related molecules, same formula, but different connectivity, different structure. Once we get those principles under control, then we're really going to leap into organic chemistry and we'll start going to worry about synthesis. How is it that we take one kind of molecule and transform it into another? What is its mechanism? What is the way that electrons flow during a chemical reaction? Do these reactions happen in one step or do they happen in multiple steps? Are there special conditions that they must be run under? Can you have water around? Is it possible that multiple products can be made, which often will be the case, and we'll learn how to predict what the most likely products are. And this is for, again, transforming from one type of molecule into another. And then once we learn how to do single transformations, we're going to put them together because the overall goal is to learn how to take a small set of common, inexpensive starting materials and be able to join them together in some way to make complex molecules, because that's modern organic synthesis. So again, starting off with some review, atomic and molecular structure, going through the framework of chemistry, kinetics, thermodynamics, equilibrium, getting into some more organic-related topics, primarily synthesis, the different aspects of synthesis, and then finally wrapping up the quarter with multi-step synthesis, how to do multiple reactions strung together. With that overview, what I wanted to do today is to do some of the machinery of OCHEM. How do we even write molecules down? How do we show that a chemical reaction is going on? What are the general ideas as far as how these transformations occur? So we're going to start, in fact, with line structures. Now, before I address the topic of line structures, one question, the most commonly asked question in this class, is it on the exam? And the answer is yes. If I write it down in here or if I say it in class, it's on the exam. If it's something that's in the textbook but it's in one of those little info boxes and I don't even refer to it, then it may not, most likely will not be on the exam. There will be a few times during the quarter where I will lecture to material that is not in the textbook. Not very frequently, but it will happen on occasion. So no matter what the circumstance is, no matter what we're going over, you never actually need to ask the question, what's on the exam? Now, I know that's not very satisfying to some of you. So those of you who have not had me as an instructor before, the third, fourth, fifth, 10,000th time that you hear me say the same thing, that's a big hint that something related to that topic is going to be showing up on the exam. I will also be generating, that's what I was holding a minute ago. Oh, already misplaced it. Well, I have a list of the different topics each day that I want to make sure that we get through. So the topics for today, in fact, are to write structures, line structures, what we're doing first. To review the principles of mechanism. How do we write down that a chemical reaction is going on? We're going to be covering functional groups, common characteristic patterns of atoms that no matter what molecule they're on, tend to have the same kind of reactivity. That's what makes modern organic chemistry possible, that we don't, for each molecule, have a unique reaction. We have features on the molecules that we target. If we still have time left today for introduction, then I want to go over these aspects of what synthesis are and then just touch briefly on stereochemistry, the fact that you can have mirror image molecules, which are identical except for the fact that they're mirror images, and also something known as regiochemistry, that if you have a large molecule, if you put an OH group, an alcohol group, one here versus here versus here, how can you accomplish putting it in different places on the molecule? Or what are the consequences of it being on different places in a molecule? So line structures. Organic molecules take an awful long time to write down on paper if you try to do it the way that you might have done it in Chem 1A. For example, and this molecule you don't have to memorize, but I like doing this example to drive home the point. Oleic acid, it's a common constituent of olive oil. Oleo from related to oil. It is an 18-carbon compound. if that took a while to write, that's not even the whole main point. Because carbon normally is what is known as tetravalent, meaning it has four connections to it, either in terms of single bonds, double bonds, triple bonds, or you can have unusual situations, reactive intermediates that maybe don't have that four number of connections. But almost always on carbon-based molecules, if you don't, by carbons or other non-hydrogen atoms, have four connections, you can almost always assume there are enough hydrogens to bring that number up to four. I think we're out of seats, but there is the wall you can lean against here if you wanted to. Okay. So that means for this molecule, I could spend another minute or two writing in all the different hydrogens that go on here. Incredibly time-wasting. And in fact, I won't complete it, because I'll just show you that the way we normally do it is like this. That is the entire structure. Organic chemists would see that and would know exactly how many hydrogens there are. And this is what is known as a line structure. So let me point out a few of the features of these line structures, a few of the rules for generating line structures, because this will be the only type of structure we operate in this quarter. There will be a few times where it's actually better practice to go ahead and write the entire structure out. But 95-98% of the time, we'll be writing these line structures. So let me address the two rules for line structures. Each of these atomic labels, those same atomic labels you learned back in Chem 1A, if you have carbon, you leave those labels out. If you have hydrogens attached to carbons, you leave those labels out as well. Everything else is left in place. So for line structures, carbon atom labels and atom labels for hydrogens connected to carbon. Are omitted. Now that means in reverse, when you're reading these structures, you always presume that carbon is tetravalent. So if you look at something like the end of this molecule, where it's just a point, that point having one line back the other direction means there's a single connection, a single bond. That means there's three other connections that should be there at that position, but by convention are not being shown. So you would have to automatically know and assume, therefore, that there are the three hydrogens there. So when reading a line structure, a carbon is assumed to be tetravalent unless otherwise notated. As we get into this course, we'll learn how to write the exceptions. And again, the way that we assume tetravalency is that for whatever is missing, we assume that hydrogen's there. Now, we have some more details for me to fill in, but any questions about this much, what I've said so far? All right. A little more terminology. There's this term, heteroatom. Hetero prefix meaning different. Atom is, of course, an atom. So a pure hydrocarbon is a molecule that only contains, as it sounds like, carbon and hydrogen. But there are a select number of elements that are commonly found in organic molecules. Oxygen being one of the main ones, sulfur, phosphorus, nitrogen, some of the halogens, chlorine, bromine, principally those two. So atoms that are not carbon or hydrogen, those are heteroatoms, those are different atoms. So one statement I could make about writing line structures is that heteroatoms are always explicitly written. If you look again, even though it's incomplete, at oleic acid I was starting to write out, you can see over on the right-hand side that we have a carbon attached to an oxygen, another oxygen, and then a hydrogen. Notice that the two oxygens are both in the final line structure. And notice also that there's this hydrogen that, since it was attached to oxygen, we don't make the same assumptions as we would for carbon. So anytime you have something attached not to carbon, usually you go ahead and write it in. So again, heteroatoms and, to be explicit about it, and hydrogens attached to heteroatoms. Are always written in line structures. The last detail about this structure I wrote, and I realize, and I may have to adjust the way that I write, I'm realizing that, might be hard to see, but there's little dots floating around the oxygens. What are those? Lone electrons, lone pairs. Some textbooks will not always show lone pairs, because once you get some experience reading organic structures, you can know just by looking at structure, oh yeah, it's got one lone pair, oh, it's got two lone pairs. Because you're beginning students, I don't want you to make that assumption. So all charges and lone electrons must always, 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 without an exception, be shown. So again, review. When writing a line structure, if it's a carbon, we generally leave it out. I'll show you momentarily a couple of situations in which you don't leave it out. And it's not a hard rule. If you want to show and highlight that you've got a particular carbon that's doing something, then it's okay for you to write it in. But the general tendency is leave the carbons out. Same thing with the hydrogens attached to carbons. We normally leave those out. Which, again, when you're going in the reverse direction, the way you read those structures is to assume that you're going to have four connections on those carbons. Heteroatoms, which are things besides carbon and hydrogen, are always left in, as well as hydrogens attached to those heteroatoms. And then in charges and lone electrons, you must always show. Any questions about any of these rules? So let me put up an example molecule, or two example molecules. I'd like to convert a regular structure that I'm about to write into a line structure, and I'd like you to convert the line structure back into, quote-unquote, a regular structure. So let's do something related to your lab coming up. So this is the structure I would like you to convert into. Ooh, wait. Convert this into a line structure, and then now convert this line structure into a quote-unquote regular structure. How are we doing? A couple more seconds. One warning about the exams. It's not always going to be that the information in the exam is difficult. It is, though, that I'm going to expect a certain level of proficiency. So, for example, at some point, once you get used to it, and I realize that physically it takes a little while to write these answers down. The first molecule, you should be able to look at it, and as you're looking at it, you should be immediately starting able to draw. So the first molecule, you should have needed no more than about 5-10 seconds. If you didn't do that now, that's fine, you're learning the system. But by the time we get to our first quiz, it should only take you those few seconds to do it. So it's not just that you know something, it's have you practiced it and used it. In section 2, I'll be speaking about the practice element later. Let's go ahead and write down these answers. The main ring of this first molecule, does anybody recognize what it looks like? Benzene, that's right. And we're going to talk more about benzene when we get to lab. But following the rules, these 6 carbons, we would leave them out, and so we would just have a hexagon. The double bonds, you do write to show the multiple connections. So there's our benzene unit. Yes?
Can we just put circle here?
Good question. It is commonly encountered that you will write benzene with just a circle. I strongly recommend against that. The reason the circle there is actually a good reason, because there are no double and single bonds in that portion of the molecule. That is a resonance structure, which there is no such thing as a resonance structure. Resonance structure means that there's an inadequacy in this writing system. These line structures, which are based on Lewis structures, are based on a classical picture of bonding in which a bond only occurs between two atoms, which is not always the case. There is, in fact, a bonding orbital that goes all the way around benzene, which means in real life, benzene has six bonds, the ones between carbon, that are between a single and double bond in length. And that's why the circle is written. However, the one usefulness about writing the double bonds that aren't really there in is you can better count electrons. So at this stage, don't use the little circles. Do use the bonds so you can count electrons. Now, the 5 hydrogens on the outside of that benzene ring you wouldn't include because they're directly connected to carbon. But we do have an oxygen. An oxygen is a heteroatom, so we write it in, along with the hydrogen that is attached to that heteroatom. Yes. It's purely aesthetics, and different people have different ways they like to do it. So, no, for my class, any way you would like to do it is fine. Yes?
For that H on the O, is it okay if you just wrote OH instead?
You know, another good question. That's a condensed structure, which I'm not going to quiz you on what the subtle distinctions are between line structures, condensed structures, and R, but just on a practical level, yes, I myself will even do that. And it would be understood that there is a single bond there. In fact, that leads me into another topic we were going to get to, which I might as well address it here, that lots and lots and lots of molecules have these OH groups, which realize that this line structure system is based on the Lewis structure, which is based on covalent bonding. So when you see OH and OChem, it does not mean hydroxide. Most of the time, it does not mean hydroxide. It is a carbon that's covalently bonded to an oxygen, which means it will not dissociate. You will not generate a basic solution from this molecule. In fact, this molecule is very vaguely acidic. So just because you see OH, erase from your mind that that means a hydroxide. Instead, we call that an alcohol. Which there is consumable alcohol, which is a kind of alcohol, a very popular kind of alcohol, but it's just one of the many molecules that has this particular functional group. Is anybody familiar with the term functional group and could give me a definition for it?
A functional group is a molecule in which that part of the molecule is having reaction, and that is proven to have similar reactions if they have this similar functional group.
That's right. So no matter what molecule it's found on, this characteristic pattern of atoms has predictable, repeatable behavior. So there's an alcohol in that molecule. Let me back up to the first page of notes, because this is another extraordinarily common functional group. Anybody happen to know the name of this functional group? Carboxylic acid, that's correct. So that's the carbon that's contained in that circle. So the carbon is part of that functional group. And then the OOH. Now, we'll come back to functional groups in a moment. Let's go ahead and get the answer to this other structure problem. Yes?
Because that's a resonance structure, you can put the OH anywhere.
On this particular molecule, yes, because there is only one what's called substituent. I'm going to use that word sooner or later, so I might as well put that here. So, substitute, to replace something. Substituent, that which is substituted by or does the substituting, depending on how you want to use the word. So what it means is I could take benzene. Let me write that up just for reference. So if we take benzene and substitute an OH group for one of the hydrogens, that's how we produce this particular molecule, which this has the name phenol, which is one of the active ingredients of chloroseptic. A substituent can be more than just a small group, though. It could be several carbons bound together, and we're going to start learning some of the names of these different groups. But substituent is a group of atoms that takes the place substitute, generally a hydrogen. So because there's only one substituent on that benzene ring, yes, it does not matter where you wrote it. But if we had two of them, then you have to keep that relative distance between the two the same. Now back to this other line structure problem. How many carbons total are in this compound?
I hear five. I hear six.
How many people think five? How many people think six?
How many people are too bored or tired to vote?
The first day, you know.
The part that often confuses people is this break that occurs. And in fact, you'll see some people, they don't even write the little space there. That's a triple bond, and a triple bond, a classical triple bond, only happens between two atoms. So this is a connection point, one carbon, and this is another connection point. And then this means over here, this corner has to be yet another carbon. So there's one, two, three carbons there, four, five, six. Again, it's the triple bond that often throws people off. So let's just write in that carbon framework. There's the six carbons. Now let's go ahead and write the hetero atoms in, because we know we always have to write those in. And then after that, we'll worry about the hydrogens involved. So at the 1, 2, 3, 4th carbon from the left, we have a chlorine. The next carbon over, there's a nitrogen. That if you wrote your bonds out, that's fine, or because the question was asked earlier, if you wanted to write it condensed, that's fine as well. But now let's go back and fill in those other hydrogens. Starting from the very left, how many does the first carbon need?
One.
Because it's already got a triple bond, so 3 plus 1 equals 4. For the second carbon over, how many hydrogens do we need on it? None, because we already have a triple bond and a single bond. So we don't put anything on there. Next position? 2, correct? Next one? 1. Next one? 0. Two single bonds to carbon, a single bond to carbon, a single bond to nitrogen, and a double bond. That's 4 connections, so nothing needed there. And then the end of the molecule? 2. I'll get into other types of functional groups a bit later, because I have some other topics I want to make sure that we squeeze in today. Questions about this, though? Now, I didn't mention this as one of the items for discussion today, but I want to throw it out there that it's coming soon. This concept of nomenclature, the naming of molecules. So you might have a very simple molecule like this, 4 carbons and a chlorine. There's another molecule that you could also have that also has 4 carbons and a chlorine. In fact, there's a couple other molecules. So there are names that we have to be able to distinguish these from one another. And just to show you a little bit about the naming system today, there are common names for some molecules, historical names, names that don't have a system to them. And then there's a systematic nomenclature. And almost universally, we follow the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry, the IUPAC rules. So some carbon compounds have regular-sounding names like pentane, hexane, heptane, octane, which, if you remember those prefixes, are 5, 6, 7, and 8 carbons. That's what the numbers mean in these names. But some of the smaller molecules have common names, like you probably have heard of propane before. You might use in a grill or something like that. Propane is a 3-carbon molecule. Butane and butane lighters, that's a 4-carbon molecule. And so these first two molecules are called forms of butane, but they have a substituent on them that we need to name as well. And it matters whether that substituent's on the end of a molecule or somewhere in the interior. We will be learning about a system where we establish location numbers for different substituents. And in this simple case, whichever way of numbering the compound gives you the lowest numbers is the way that we number it. So chlorine being on the right-hand side, we give the first carbon, not the chlorine, the first carbon, number one. In the second molecule over, because chlorine is closer to the right side, that's why we start numbering it there. The third molecule we'll talk about later how we properly name it. But for these first two, we can show where that substituent is. We have a prefix. I can spell correctly. That shows there's a chlorine there. And then we tack on the backbone, the carbon backbone name at the end. So that molecule is called 1-chlorobutane. Distinguishes it from 2-chlorobutane. Do not worry too much about learning nomenclature yet. It's more to show you, because you're going to see a lot of these names show up in your text early on. I've warned the first section already. The second section, we are going to be jumping from section to section in the textbook. And that's partly because of the way our curriculum for this course is designed. It doesn't 100% match the chapter order in the text. So by necessity, I've got to go a little out of order. And then there's also the way I've been teaching O-Chem the last few years. I've got an order that I like to present things in because I feel that it's easier to learn that way. And again, doesn't quite 100% match with the textbook. So when you see the syllabus, don't be scared that we're only doing a couple of these sections and a few over here and a few over here. I'll make sure to very clearly indicate what's going on in lecture. From what I've talked about so far, structure writing and functional groups are the two big things you need to know. This about nomenclature is just so that you have a little clue what's going on when you see these names start to appear in the text. So again, the ones and twos and such tell you where things are located. Chloro, you'd probably pretty readily figure out that's referring to the chlorine. And then butane, that bute part of it, is a common name indicating four carbon. So I'll actually defer questions about this topic until we'll have a whole day where we do nothing about nomenclature, except nomenclature. So let's move to the other big topic I want to make sure that we got to, which is mechanism. The mechanism is one of the reasons that we have such a highly developed O-Chem synthesis. Because instead of just the old days of, oh, well, this molecule reacted this way when we put this reagent in, you memorize that. You memorize that it does this thing with this compound. You memorize it does this thing with this compound. Well, we now have the ability to try to figure out what physically is going on in the chemical reaction. So instead of just learning reagents and how they pair up with molecules, we learn what those reagents do. The step-by-step process, and that step-by-step process is called a mechanism. The step-by-step flow of electrons in a chemical reaction. I'll go ahead and use this abbreviation, RxN, if you haven't seen it before, extraordinarily common shorthand for reaction. Let me switch to a new page so I have more room. And I'll show you a reaction mechanism. Very simple one. One that you're going to do in your first lab, in fact. And that's an acid-base neutralization. So let's take that molecule, phenol, that we had earlier. And let's say that we reacted it with sodium hydroxide. Now notice the way that I wrote hydroxide. I've got my minus sign in a little circle. That's done because an older way of writing lone pairs is to write just a line. And so to distinguish a line meaning a lone pair versus a line meaning a negative charge, way back when I learned chemistry, I was told put circles around your charges. It's actually a common convention, and so I'm going to continue to follow it. Whether you put circles or not, it's not required on your part as long as I can tell what you're writing. Phenol, to use some language we're going to get just a few weeks from now, has a pKa of 10. For those of you who didn't totally let Chem 1A drain out of your brains over the summer, what does a pKa of 10 signify?
Acidic.
That's why we're going to be doing some review later on in the quarter. So pKa is the negative log of Ka, which is the equilibrium constant for the autoionization of this molecule. In other words, if you just put it in a solution, will the proton come off? That's what Ka tells you. Big Ka means small pKa because it's a negative log. So pKa of 10 is actually a pretty large number. It means a Ka that's 10 to the negative 10, which means this thing doesn't want to dissociate. If it doesn't want to dissociate, which means it doesn't want to give off its hydrogen, then we say it's a what? Not a base, because the lack of hydrogen coming off does not mean it wants to grab hydrogen. So it means it's just not very acidic. It's a weak acid. pKa, what I just said about that, again, not a topic for you to worry about right now, but every word of what I just said, you're going to need to know about 4 or 5 weeks from now. So just signaling that that's coming. That's really what today is about. Give you structure, writing, and mechanism, and warn you of the things to start preparing on. So we have a weak acid, phenol. We have a relatively strong base, hydroxide. I say relatively because in organic land, hydroxide can actually be a very weak base. Organic molecules, if you rip their protons off of them, can be so basic that they'll ignite in open atmosphere because they so desperately want to grab protons from anything, including the surrounding air. But, long story made short, an acid-base reaction is going to happen. The hydroxide is going to get the hydrogen, and then the hydrogen can only have one bond at a time, normally. And so it's going to lose the bond that it has with phenol. This is the way that we show this. And in any mechanistic arrow, because that's what this thing is, a mechanism arrow, in any mechanistic arrow, here, where the start of the arrow is where electrons come from. The other end, the point, is where the electrons go to. I'll say it one more time. The tail of the arrow, the base of the arrow, is where the electrons come from, and the head of the arrow, the point of the arrow, is where the electrons go to. It is not which way atoms move. Mechanism arrows always show the flow of electrons, not atoms. There may be cases where the molecule moves the same direction as the electrons. For example, you could argue that the hydroxide, yeah, it's going to reach out to grab that hydrogen. But the arrow's not showing that. It's showing that the electrons are reacting with the hydrogen. So that's a bond-forming event. Because I'm taking a lone pair and attacking something to make that new bond. Similarly, we also have a bond-breaking event. We have a day where we're going to cover more about mechanism, so later I'll introduce these terms heterogenesis and heterolysis. The fact that we're generating a bond by a lone pair of electrons, two electrons moving to make that move, that bond move. And when that OH bond breaks, it only breaks one way, which means the hydrogen, if it was by itself, would be positively charged. The oxygen would be negatively charged. That is two contrasting charges, which is why we call it heterolysis, uneven breaking. To simplify just for the moment, I will tell you that the arrowhead itself means an electron pair moves. To show you what the other arrow would look like, if you write only a hook, a half of the head, then that is showing that a single electron moves. So what's the end result? Well, the oxygen-hydrogen bond broke, There were two lone pairs in oxygen to start with. Because the bond broke, it leaves a third lone pair, which means that you're going to now have a negative charge. You're going to generate the ion phenoxide. Oxide meaning something that's charged. The phen part coming from phenol. We'll also have water as our other product. We're not going to do much with these mechanism arrows yet. But because of the way Chapter 1 is structured in this textbook, Chapter 1 has a review of atomic orbitals, bonding, acid-base chemistry, and mechanism all interspersed with each other. We're skimming over acid-base chemistry for the moment. Because of that, I want you to have seen these mechanism arrows. Any questions about the arrows or mechanism? Now, we're very limited on time, so let me just briefly introduce. I think I'll have to put synthesis towards another day. Or no, let's do stereochemistry later. Let's talk about synthesis. As I was mentioning, especially to Section 1 this morning, someone asked when they looked on the syllabus, what's this problem workshop we're going to be doing later? One of the most common types of... Oh, you're smiling already. One of the most common types of problems is something like this, where you start off, for example, with an alcohol that's one type of functional group. You react it with some reagent that has some kind of predictable reactivity with alcohols. And if you knew this reagent, you would know that in the place of an OH group, at the end of a chemical reaction, you're going to have a bromine instead. Now, I'm going to write the mechanism only to show you what a mechanism looks like. Do not worry about memorizing this yet. But if you look at the structure of PBr3, it's an electrophile. It's electron poor, because in fact, if you look at it, it does not have a complete octet, which means that it's going to be fairly reactive. What can happen, in fact, is the oxygen from the alcohol can provide some electron density to that phosphorus. And if it does so, you first temporarily have a charge on that oxygen because you've made a new bond. At the same time that's happening, a bromine gets kicked off. And that's something, in fact, we will discuss when we come back to mechanism. Sometimes, only one arrow may be in a step. And there might be another step after that, and another one, and another one. So you have what's called a stepwise mechanism. Here, we have two arrows at the same time, and that's what is known as a concerted mechanism. Think of the word concert. After that occurs, this intermediate's acidic, so a hydrogen drops off. Notice the arrow does not go to hydrogen because the arrow shows where the electrons go, not where the hydrogen goes. Then that bromine that got kicked off earlier, which is now bromide, the ion, comes back later and substitutes. I certainly can. And again, do not worry about memorizing this mechanism. It's to show you what you're going to have to learn, one of the things that you'll learn for each reaction. Now, in this one reaction, we have the substrate, the starting molecule. We have certain reagents that are used. And then we have the product. After we get through all these introductory details of acid-base chemistry, mechanism, kinetics, thermodynamics, we're going to start learning, well, what do different reagents do to alcohols? What is the mechanism? If I gave you an alcohol and a reagent, can you predict its product? If I give you a product and show you the starting reagent, or starting material, the substrate, can you figure out the appropriate reagent that's going to go there? So this was a little bit of information overload. This was an introduction to a quarter. again, on a practical level, structure writing, functional groups, and the small aspect of what a mechanism is are the three most important things that came from today's lecture. Section two, we now need to move on to lab. Section one, please understand, I do need to go off with them to start lab. So I know that some of you from section one might have questions. If you do, follow me over to the lab. Section two, follow me over there, and all registration questions I will tackle over there. Thank you, everyone.